You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Blessed above all of creation, it was a rare and precious pearl. Conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free, it was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize, confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid a child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand.
Well, good morning, listeners, to Connecting the Dots. We are having a wonderful program today. We are going to be talking with ex-NYU professor Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, who has a great story about liberalism and just exactly how it changed his life. And I want to remind our listeners that this program goes out worldwide via podcast, as well as being broadcast through radio networks around the country. But I do want our listeners to go to our to mydanhappel.com site, and you're welcome to listen to this program on archive, because occasionally we run into problems with broadcasting just because we're talking about things that the mainstream media doesn't want to talk about. So let me introduce Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He is notorious because he was a professor at NYU, and Dr. Rechtenwald at one time was a confirmed communist socialist, and over a period of time he saw some of the problems with political correctness and some of the thought police and the lack of free speech that was happening at the university level. And it made him rethink how he saw the world of collectivism, because he realized there was a lot of authoritarianism that went with that plan, and ultimately that it would end up stifling free speech. So with that, Dr. Rechtenwald, you have a number of books, and you've written some terrific things, and I want you to go ahead and lead in any way you want to, but let's expose the so-called liberal left for just exactly what they are, and that is control freaks.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me on, first of all. And I'm very glad to be here and to have a chance to talk to your audience about this and with you, of course. I refer to what people call liberals or so-called liberals. I call them the illiberal left because there are no liberals left. Whatever they once were, the classical liberals, you know, of the John Stuart Mill variety, which was basically the individual's liberty comes first. It is the thing that society is supposed to protect. But, of course, this is not at all the way the collectivist left, illiberal left, thinks. Everything is sacrificed for the collective until everybody's dead. And that's not really that much of an exaggeration. So what happened with me is I was a left communist, which is left of the Bolsheviks, believe it or not. you know, it was one of these Marxists who thought it just wasn't done right that time, or 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 that time. You know, that next time, it's always next time it'll be right, and that the ideal is noble, and that's worth pursuing. But whenever the character of the left came out, especially after I violated some taboos in terms of political correctness and social justice ideology as a leftist, and was attacked by thousands of people, and you know, on the internet, and then dozens, and shunned by over 100 people in my program at NYU, and cruelly lambasted and lied about, libeled and slandered through an email list to official NYU administrators and faculty. I saw just what the character of these people were. Then I started to investigate the I started investigating the basis of all this, and it was, you know, I knew about the terror in the Soviet Union. I knew about the Red Guard in China. I just thought this was based on Stalinism, not on the actual ideology, that it was an aberration. But having read much more deeply, I know now that's not true at all. The terror started right after the revolution in 1918. The revolution was 1917, but by January of 18, Lenin was already rounding up workers, striking workers, the very people on whose behalf the revolution was supposedly undertaken, and shooting them in the head. When I started to research and go into the criminality of the left, I was stunned, and also found it very difficult to find. A lot of it's buried in every field of study. The leftist rules, leftism rules everything in the academy, of course. Except the sciences, also they're permeating that as well. But I couldn't find the things that I knew I'd read elsewhere, like on the internet, and I tried to get really like peer-reviewed sources for what I was seeing, and it wasn't there. They just have scrubbed it. They've scrubbed it. They've scrubbed the crimes. They've scrubbed the histories. They've scrubbed all kinds of things. It's incredible. So I decided to, you know, first of all, I wrote my book Springtime for Snowflakes, which was a story of what happened to me at NYU, and then it's a memoir that goes back into my own graduate school education to trace the roots of this social justice PC authoritarianism to the very sources that I was studying in graduate school. So it's very interesting. I show just where all these things come from, and I go, aha, there it was. This crazy thing came from that crazy idea, and so on and so forth. So I can give examples, but that's the short of it. My new book is called that book was Springtime for Snowflakes. My new book is called Google Archipelago, in which I trace the rampant leftism and leftist authoritarianism of cyberspace, and it's frightening. As you were mentioning, it's a frightening prospect what we're looking at.
It is, and Michael, one of the things that, and you're going to get into this in quite a bit of detail, but one of the things that is so sad about liberalism is so many people get involved with it, thinking that they're really promoting freedom and good ideas, and that liberalism is very much like the old, what we refer to as classical liberalism, which is really open thought and what our country was founded on. And in fact, the new liberalism is the exact opposite. It's all about control. It's all about taking away people's rights. It's all about managing everything we do from cradle to grave. And
here's how they do it. Here's how they do it. They do it in the name of the supposed minorities and marginalized and subordinated ones. So it's a paternalistic cover they use a paternalistic cover for the for those who are on the margin, so-called, or subordinated, use that then to utterly subordinate everyone. It's a complete con game. It's a shell game.
It is. It is. And we've got so many things tied into this shell game. We've got environmentalism. We've got all these things that are designed to control literally everything we do, and it's all about consumerism, it's all about industry, it's all about productivity, right. Everything. This is not a one-shot deal. This is to literally take away everything we, every right we have, and control us in every aspect of our lives from cradle to grave, right?
That's right, and let me just say this. This is what I'm going to say now would only surprise leftists, okay? Because leftism is like a program that you, once you install it, it runs certain features. I'll put it that way, okay? One of the features that it tells the leftist to believe is that you are the underdog. You are the marginalized. Leftism is a marginalized ideology. We're trying to get in any form of power, trying to get any form of power we can, but we're just left out. This is very interesting because it's absolutely the inverse of the truth. Leftism is running everything. And another thing leftists believe, only right-wing ideology supports capitalism. No, that's absolutely false. In fact, I've got the history of corporate leftism and corporate socialism in my next book, and it's about monopoly capitalism running on the top level and a kind of so-called socialism on the ground for everybody else. This is the game. This is the game they're playing. This is what they're setting up. China is the model.
Yes, and last week we had Dennis Cuddy on, and Dennis Cuddy refers to it as the political elite. And basically what it is it's a return to good old German fascism, national socialism, where the means of production are still in private hands somewhat, but they're completely controlled by the state. And that's what the new corporatism is.
Here's what I think it is, actually. It's a slight difference, and this is why I call it Google Marxism. And that is this. The corporations are taking the functions of the state over. They are becoming the state. So, first of all, right now they're going to be amplifying the powers of the state vis-a-vis the technologies of AI and the whole cybernetic cultural and technological apparatuses that will know every move you make, not only where you are, but exactly what you're doing. Down to the finger motion, because the whole world is going to be digitized vis-a-vis cameras that are going to turn every one of your actions into a digital film, digital reproductions that are going to be sent to central authorities if necessary. And all of this is taking place under the aegis or under the rubric of equality. So the reason I wouldn't call it Nazism is this, or fascism rather, is this. Fascism goes under different ideological terms. They're going to use the equality, equity, inclusion, and diversity goody-two-shoe type sounding things to make the medicine go down. And this is the game. This is why they're allowing people like Bernie Sanders and Cortez to get all this airtime. I mean, if socialists like that were really a threat, do you think the corporate masters would allow them so much time? No, because they're not a threat. They're doing what the corporations want them to do on the ground.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And well, you're referring to, and we've talked about this quite a bit on a radio show, is techno-feudalism, because the bottom line is we end up being controlled by the technology that they sell as being something that's just going to make our lives so wonderful and easy. And in fact, it's just tightening the noose around our neck and making control that much easier for the people in charge.
Yeah, there's two facets to it. First of all, it's feudalism because it is highly stratified, and the stratification is very rigid, it's static. That is, if you're not involved in the highest levels of in corporations, if you're not involved with the monopolists, either some handmaiden to them or in the, or part of their regime, you're going to be basically in a different level. There'll be equality for everybody else. By them, of course, they don't need equality. What do they need equality for? You're going to be running it, so they don't need equality. So this is why I say I'm careful to very clearly say, I call it Google Marxism because it is, first of all, they're using socialist ideology to perpetrate people's acceptance of this, so that it's like, oh, everything's great, it's going to be equal, everybody will have an equal income. Blah, blah, blah. Universal basic income will probably come into play because, the displacement of jobs based on AI. And then it'll be this set of reduced expectations for everybody. And people will, unfortunately, many people will trade their futures, their possibilities for security, so-called economic security. Mm-hmm. And also they'll trade their freedom cybersecurity, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and we talked about this briefly off the air, but a perfect example is the social credit system that
right.
Google helped to design for the communist Chinese government. And it's right. being very effective, and I think it's the test bed for the United States.
As a matter of fact, Australia is already purchasing it. They're going to roll it out in a city in Australia. I forget the name of the city, but it's easily found. They're called smart cities, as they call it. These smart cities will know everybody's location within it, and they'll actually have sort of digital leashes on people, such that your leash only goes so far based on your social credit, so that say you're a 6, you have X, this is your perimeter. You're a 9. You could go outside of the city, maybe outside of the state, maybe even out of the country. But there's going to be a kind of social digital fences and digital leashes on people that if people cross that digital fence or overextend the digital leash, it will trigger the authorities, and then, of course, they know exactly where you are. And that's that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a digital gulag.
Yeah, it's a digital gulag, and that's an excellent title for your new book.
That's part of it. It's called The Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag, and The Simulation of Freedom. The idea there being we're going to be in a digital gulag, but people are going to have this, how you have this sense of going online, you're free to roam and all that. That's a simulation only because everything you do is watched and monitored, and how is that freedom, right?
Right, exactly. How is it that so many of the useful idiots, and that's mm-hmm. a term Lenin used, the useful idiots are buying into this whole program? I come from a very liberal background myself. I come from a family. My father was a card-carrying communist at one time in his life. And the whole family was that way. What is it about people that they are so naive and so willing to accept some of the stupidest and the most benign ideas in the entire world?
One of the things about leftists and communists is that they think they're oppositional and radical. And this is one of the biggest, identity boosters they get. Sort of, if you look at it as a program that gets downloaded into the brain. It comes with this one feature that says, you're a wild man. You're a really radical dude. Keep that up. Meanwhile, what they're doing is actually favoring the corporate monopolists in every way. I show in my next book how perfectly leftist ideology lines up with corporate objectives. And they'll never, this is good. If they read it, this will blow up their heads. Because it is, they'll just deny it, I guess. I don't know what they'll do, but it's irrefutable. I show one point after another how leftism lines up perfectly with corporate globalist monopolist objectives.
And you're right, and they always hold up the capitalism and the so-called right-wing people as being the ones that are the real problem for the world, and how they're there to represent the little guy, when in fact they're the ones that are promoting all this technical feudalism.
That's right. It's incredible. So there's a I call this notion the default no-fault ideology, that leftism believes that it's the default no-fault ideology. And that is to say, coming again with the program, part of the package, is this idea that we're not only benign, our beliefs are obviously benign, obviously, irrefutably benign, but also beneficial. So that it comes with this belief that it's the beneficial way, and that anything opposes it has to be evil. And therefore, that then lines up with a set of beliefs that happen to support tyranny, for lack of a better word. I mean, really, there's no other word to put it. Tyranny, totalitarianism, whatever. So they just end up supporting tyranny. They think they're doing good. They're unbelievably I know this because I believe you can't even imagine the extent to which they cannot even imagine being wrong. Can't even think it. It's not a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're right. In fact, on my announcement for the program, that's exactly what I talked about. It seems like that no matter what, they're right, we're wrong, and they're not going to admit that whatever they're promoting has been tried many, many times, and it's failed every time.
Mm-hmm. The reason what they have, again, I know this analogy may be overstretched, but coming with the program, the EXE file or the APT file, if they're running Mac, is another set of instructions that says, that only failed because capitalism got in the way. That only failed because capitalism antagonized it. You can't have socialism unless it's global. So any failure is always accounted for, you see. So they always blame the enemy, the other side, for their failures. The failure of the Soviet Union. Oh, they had to face all these powerful imperialist nations. The failure of Cuba. Well, you know, they've been isolated, cut off economically and so on by the U.S. and the embargo. The failure of Venezuela. Well, that was actually caused by Obama and OPEC driving down the oil prices. Everything is excused. Everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're right. And they seem to be able to reuse the same arguments over and over again. And that's the sad part about it, because most intelligent people learn from their mistakes. And a lot of these people are some of the brightest people, as far as intellectual ability.
They're very bright.
Naivete, they're right up there at the top of the list, too.
It is amazing. And so it takes people that are very talented, and then it augments the talent by virtue of giving them a systematic way of thinking that sounds unbelievable, that sounds like a freight train coming at you. That given all this rhetoric and this incredible language that avails you, it's like a preset package of vocabulary, phraseology, all this. It comes with it. Okay. I know this metaphor, but it really is like that. And they sound brilliant, some of these people. I mean, just brilliant. Mm-hmm. But you know what? They're not actually thinking. This is not thought. What they're doing is rehearsing. It's purely rehearsing a certain set of phraseology that gets this plug-and-play phraseology. It is not thinking. I guarantee you it's not thought. It is just phraseology that's plugged and played together, and it rolls out. And it sounds good. It has a certain force. It has eloquence, oftentimes, extremely powerful rhetoric, but absolutely no thinking involved. None.
Well, and I think certainly one of the reasons for that is that we've seen our whole
education system, academia, has suffered greatly at the hands of progressives like Dewey and people who have been trying for a century or more to meld us with one world Marxism or communism. And it's destroyed our education system, and we see it with Common Core. We see it with a lot of different things. And, Doctor, you've certainly seen it at the university level in a big way, because NYU is one of the more progressive institutions in the country.
Well, let me just say, I can't really, believe it or not, say that much about NYU. Being the behemoth they are, they have my hands tied in a certain way that I can't get into.
Sure.
But let's
just
take an example of how a student applying for Stanford University in 2017, when in fact they had plans to admit the smallest number of first-year students, we can't call them freshmen anymore because you can't use the word man, first-year students, the smallest class in history, with, according to their own administrators, the greatest talent and diversity, of course, that they had ever seen. Yet, a particular student, when asked in his essay, "What matters to you and why," wrote, and I quote, "#Black Lives Matter 100 times," end quote, and was admitted. Okay, so what does that say? It says to me, they want people to repeat slogans ad nauseum. They don't care if you think. They're trying to produce a certain ideological product. And that's it. I mean, if they admit that student, it proves that what they want are people that don't think but just repeat certain correct thoughts. Or not thoughts, but phrases, right? So that person they know will go to the next protest of a conservative speaker who possibly might reach the lectern and make sure they shout them down so that nothing else is ever heard. I saw it happen at NYU. I've seen it happen where a speaker comes, and I've tried to listen, and they start the chanting, they start the signage, they start the screaming, and the person gets not a word in edgewise. We saw it happen at Middlebury with Charles Murray when he tried to just talk about something completely benign with reference to any racial thing, and he's never been a racist. He just put some results on a bell curve, and they just happened to be the truth. These students haven't a clue what the guy thinks. They don't even know what a thought is in the first place. They don't know how to think. They just know how to repeat the proper phrases. That's what education has become. It's a total waste, worse than a waste. It's worse than a waste. It is a positive negative. It is completely, completely destroyed.
Well, it's indoctrination, and it's fascinating to me if you look at who's behind much of the Common Core curriculum now. People like Bill Gates is one of the biggest promoters of Common Core, and it's to make good workers, not good thinkers.
Yeah, they don't want thinkers at all. There's no question that thought is not the objective. So putting out smart people. Listen, and in fact, as far as the United States goes, all they need is a certain technoid type, which they can get from another country. So they don't care what they do here. As far as education, they could turn this just in. The United States could be a sea of vapid, utterly vapid consumeristic nonsense. They don't care if we know anything. In fact, the less we know, the better. And so the training is going on in a much cheaper setting in other countries. Then those people are brought here using the visa that they keep open for that at the H-1. And that's where they're getting the talent they need. They don't need anything else. They need techno-bureaucratic type thought, so-called. They don't want critical thought. They say critical thinking when they talked about English classes. No, trust me. I've seen a lot of these English classes. There was no critical thinking going on at all. It's shut down by virtue of the fact that if anybody has a differing opinion, then the professor or the reading that they're trying to shove down their throats, it's completely shut down.
Well, we see a lot of young people who do have more open minds and open thoughts and still entertain freedom are being, they're being ostracized in the classroom. They're being identified and ostracized by the very professors that are supposedly there to teach them how to think properly, how to have an open mind.
Obviously, I don't want to paint a pathetic picture of hopelessness, and if I've done so far, I don't mean to. That's right. There are always exceptions, and there are people that are able to resist indoctrination or to use their thoughts and think through it. And I, you know, something breaks the loop of programming, you know, one way or another, and then they start to have, you know, oppositional or different critical perspectives on things. And those people are out there. There are definitely students like that. I've had them, you know, basically when I taught at NYU towards the end, they would be rallying around me. I don't want to have a cult of personality. I just treat each one as an individual, try to help them navigate the terrain and what they're dealing with, which is not easy because almost everybody they're encountering is a social justice incubator type of professor. So, you know, and I'm thinking about writing a manual about how these kind of students can navigate the social justice university.
I think that would be a very worthwhile project, and I want to approach something that you've kind of alluded to, and that is with the education system, we can bring people in from other countries to provide the technical ability, and so they really don't care about educating Americans. And the bottom line is we're supposed to destroy our economy and send all of our manufacturing to cheap labor countries all over the world. And the fact is the leveling of the United States to bring us down to the standards of the rest of the world is what the whole plan is all about.
No, that's absolutely correct. The idea is to level us and to get us what I'm calling basically an acceptance of reduced circumstances, if you will, or reduced, it's a reduced standard of living that they would like us to accept, and that's the role of people like Sanders and, or, you know, the whole socialist cadre that's out there. Those people are actually, they're not doing this intentionally. They're unwitting dupes. But those people's, their function is to create this notion of equality. It's going to be an equality, all right, but it'll be an equality of extremely reduced expectations. And that's what they're trying to push, exactly. They'll be like, everybody's equal. We all get our UBI, which may be, you know, $1,500 a month if they're lucky. And, you know, basically we're like kind of very low. It's going to be, it's Soviet-like in the end in terms of, like, the conditions. So except that we'll all have a computer and an iPhone so they can track us.
But the rest of private property will be a thing of the past, and that's really what they want to do is they want to take away all of the things that allow us to be independent, things like automobiles and single-family houses, things like that will be what goes with the rest of the program.
Also, entrepreneurialism is something they want to crush. They don't want entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are a threat. They want to get rid of competition. This goes back, by the way, and it's represented in my book. This idea, believe it or not, goes all the way back to the turn of the 20th century. And there was a gentleman whose company is still marked by its wokeness, if you will, and that is Gillette. Gillette, as I talk about in Google Archipelago, was a corporate socialist. He wanted to roll out a one-world corporation, as he called it, world corporation, that would be both the state and the only producer of anything. Everyone would work for it, and everyone would be under its sway. It would be utterly, completely powerful. So, I mean, this is ideal of corporate socialism, which is really what this is about, because it goes fairly far back. And also, a little known to a lot of people is that the United States, certain capitalists have always wanted a monopoly. They don't want a free market, some of them. They want to get rid of competition because competition is the problem. You can't have domination and complete surety of wealth with competition. So one of the ways they get rid of competition is through socialist ideology. So they make a great, this is one of the things it does is it makes half the people who are exposed to it say, I can't get anywhere. I'm in the working class. There's no chance for me to do anything. So they give up in advance. That's first part of it. Then the second part of it is that they actually use the state to suppress any competition as well.
Yeah, that's we've seen that a lot. I mean, John D. Rockefeller, a lot of the biggest names in the really the power elite, and that's a good term. Cuddy uses right. that term, and I think it's right.
Yeah, that's the right term.
A lot of those people think that way.
Yes, and they funded the Soviet Union. I mean, they funded the revolution and the Soviet Union. It would not have happened had it not been for the money that was gushing into the coffers of the Bolsheviks over there, into their
right.
personal bank accounts also, but also into the military, into the hired military. The so-called revolutionaries were mostly hired thugs, okay? It was as if they went to the prison and said, hey, you guys are killers. Why don't you come out? We'll give you like $100 a day just to kill for free. Kill freely. Do whatever you like. Kill everybody in sight. Basically, that's what they did. And it started from day one. So if anybody says, oh, no, it only started with Stalin, I'll tell you what. It started in January of 1918 where they started shooting workers dead. Anybody yeah. that strike, and they were starving them to death. They had promised them a classless society. They ended up with the classes within the working class, like innumerable layers of working class, so that, you know, it determined how much money you got paid and how much food you got rationed, and depending upon what job you had. So they made even a more stratified class system than it existed before. Everything they say is a lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've hit it right on the head, right down the line. I want to really talk about what you perceive as the future of mankind if we don't get this ship turned around. I mean,
yeah.
I see this as being a world that is the antithesis of everything that we hear from the left that they believe in, all this freedom, all these protecting the rights of minorities, all this stuff. I want your vision for the world that they're going to be producing.
Okay. Let's start with like how it's going to happen. First of all, I think the big question is why I'm writing this in terms of technology and Google Archipelago. Google is just a stand-in name for the whole archipelago of corporate technology, digital, big digital, I call it elsewhere. It is going to have both economic superpower plus governmental power. Whether it becomes the government or not really doesn't matter, because it augments the power of the government thousandfold. Whether or not Chinese AI is implemented here first or U.S. AI could make some difference. If it's Chinese AI, you know what it is. It's Project Dragonfly, which they got busted trying to set up in the Soviet Union, where when you search something, if it was something that was forbidden to be searched, they went right to the state. So Google was actually working on this. They had 100 engineers working on it. They got busted as the CEO was put before Congress. If they hadn't been busted, this would have been gone through, Project Dragonfly. So Project Dragonfly, the rating system, all that. What I think is if Chinese AI, I've read several books that suggest Chinese AI, we're at the implementation stage. All the hard intellectual work has been done. It's now about to be rolled out in mass. If it's Chinese, you can look at our society as basically an open-air prison. If it's U.S. first, it'll be basically what you'll have is a bunch of social justice robots running around. Basically, SJWs, technological SJWs. Basically, like, for example, let me just tell you something. I had a story. This is amazing what happened. I was driving with a friend, so I have proof of this, and we took a rest stop, and I just happened to let a certain word slip out, the F-bomb, and out of nowhere, Siri corrected me, "Michael, watch your language," like this. Never had this happen before. Okay, so it said to me, "We're going to be patrolled by SJW bots. We're going to be like, that is not politically correct, that is not. So there's going to be that element. And then, of course, the total control element, which comes from the Chinese AI. If they put the two together, we're going to be looking at a social justice prison, effectively. There's no, they don't even use the pretense of freedom. That's not even in their language. They don't care about that. They haven't said it for years. Liberty is not an issue for them. They want us to sacrifice the liberty of everybody for the so-called equality of these ones that are supposedly underneath us in some sort of way, some sort of hierarchy, which is nonsense. They're using those people. This is why they keep emphasizing difference, and equality at the same time. It creates the cognitive dissonance. Like, wait a minute, it's not really difference. It's what it is. It's not really equality. I mean, it's like, they want a reverse hierarchy where those who were supposedly on the top are now on the bottom and vice versa. So they're using identity as a weapon against us. They have weaponized identity. They have weaponized technology. And it could be a kind of social justice prison with SJW bots everywhere. Correcting us, and the digital leashes and the digital fences and all that, just a lot of constraints on us. The scoring system could be according to social justice scoring. Is he good in a social justice way or not? And that could be the means by which they control us. So it's always been a lie. Social justice has never been for the so-called beneficiaries thereof. It's about a disciplinary mechanism for the rest.
Right.
That's short-term.
It's
long-term.
It's a control mechanism. Right.
Yeah. Disciplinary. It's a way of keeping, of punishment and keeping you in line so that also that you internalize it. It has less to do. It tries to instill a moral system at the same time.
Yeah, what you're describing, I saw a film on YouTube about what they're doing in communist China and how the people who were dissidents that were had the ability to speak out against the system a little bit under this new program. They just cut the amount of food they get, where they get to live. Everything in their physical environment is controlled by a computer that gives them a social score based on how good a little commies they are.
Exactly. That's basically what we're going to say. Instead of commies, it'll be social justice. How good of little social justice people we are, which really comes down to commies anyway. It's about whether we're deferring to those who have been those who have been marginalized, subordinated, oppressed, and those with more intersectional vectors going through them. How do you treat them? That's where your point structure is going to come from. On that scale, most white men are going to be penalized pretty severely. They're already being penalized severely.
Oh yeah, we've seen the evil one.
We've been born with original sin that we cannot expiate. It can't be. Unlike in Christianity, there's a possibility of being forgiven and absolved. But in this social justice ideology, there's no expiating this guilt. You can't have any way out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and it's based on certainly an atheistic, humanistic.
No, totally. They take, yes, that's right. It's atheistic and materialistic, but they take some of the eschatology that is the kind of, in Christianity, the eschatology is that in the South, Jesus will come back, he'll reign for 1,000 years, and then there'll be this sorting out of the souls and so forth. They use that kind of an eschatology, but devoid of any real belief, anything beyond the material world, yes.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned how they use minorities, and we had a program the other day that we were talking about the Native Americans, how there's a new sense of tribalism. There's a new sense of taking away the land of the people who have settled much of the country and
yeah.
giving it back to the Native Americans. It's called... It's a universal thing, and it's the UN has been promoting it, but it's
mm-hmm.
called the Indigenous Peoples Treaties. And,
yes,
and ultimately, what they want to do is take away everything that we've earned give it back to people who were here originally. Well, bottom line is it gets people off the countryside. What a great way to consolidate us into their little stack and pack cities. Right.
That's right. That's one thing. And see, the ruling elite pays for their sins using us as their sacrifices. So what they do is they commit crimes across the globe and historically. Hmm. Then they sacrifice people that look like them, in effect, to the rest of society and say, look, we're making them pay. Don't worry. But we're just proxies for their crimes. We're proxies serving their sentences. So, for example, that's why whites are being used, because whites are being picked on and whites are being sacrificed because they look like the people that did the crimes, for example. And I think in the last wars, for example, how come since the Iraq War there was this vilification? After 9/11, there was this terrible vilification of Islamic and Muslim people. Then they went over and killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, and then ruined their lives. Then now they are then taking out the guilt that they should be feeling, and they're trying to put it on us and saying that we're now Islamophobic because we don't accept the people that are now having to exile their countries because they have nowhere to live, because they've debased their economies, and so on and so forth. It's just a typical way that they look like they use us ineffectively as voodoo dolls to sacrifice for their... They don't really feel guilt. What I'm trying to say is they're actually... Their criminality has a certain culpability attached to it, necessarily. And in order to expiate or get rid of it, they use us as a proxy to satisfy the cult, the society at large.
Right, right. Well, Eisenhower, who I'm still not a big fan of him, but he referred to it as the military-industrial complex. Fact is, it's corporatism who have profited from every single war and every single human life that they've shed. They've somehow managed to profit from it, and we're paying the price.
They profit, we pay. Like Halliburton and, of course, Dick Cheney had major stockholding there. And their profits went through beyond the roof. I mean, astronomical profits then, of course, which he has reaped. And yet now we're now the bad people as far as Islamist people go. We're guilty of this or that because they're now going to be – and have they ruined Europe by virtue of this? I mean – I'm just saying that the culture of Europe has not the character of culture of European culture anymore at all. I mean, look at France; it burned down churches. It's just I'm not Islamophobic. what I am is, though, I'd like to have my culture, like my culture, protected, because it's the roots and the soil that I need to live, just like they need theirs. We shouldn't have destroyed theirs and then allow them to come in and destroy ours.
Right, right. It's all part of the bigger plan, and you know, you've alluded to this. This isn't something that's happening accidentally, and it's not happening that all these useful idiots are being used in the way they are just because, well, we're just trying to do the right thing. This
right.
is about control, it's about power, and it's about ultimately ending up to the benefit of the power elite.
Yeah, isn't it curious how, you know, with this latest, you know, with the all this business about Trump and Russia the CIA and FBI, you had the left lining up behind the deep state, in effect, and supporting and cheering them on. Also, basically becoming a new McCarthyism, screaming about Russia, 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 as if they were like the new Red Scare, except it's no longer red, but it's still Russian. I mean, they just don't. I mean, it's incredible how they just use them, and these people think they're serving some sort of good thing, and or screaming at everybody about racism or Islamophobia and all this. They're just patrol officers put in place on the local level by the state. And these people don't realize they're actually functionaries of the state itself.
Exactly. They're actually the ones that are promoting exactly what they claim to be against.
Exactly. It's funny. It's really something.
Yeah.
It's really something.
It's sad, and I know that I haven't talked with you about this, but you know, the climate scare, the so-called global warming scare. I see that as being just one more tool of radicalism and the power elite to try to destroy society and to control everything we do.
Well, I look at it like this. There's been a series of what I call left catastrophism, going all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century and somewhat into the 19th. There was one thing after another that was going to destroy us, and it all came out of what I call leftist catastrophism, or was an example of leftist catastrophism. It was at one point, it was population. Remember, like in the 70s, population's going to explode. We're going to all die and blah, blah, blah. There'll be mass starvation. By now, we're supposed to have been dead. That never happened. Then there was, what else was there? There was ozone layer.
Well, there was global cooling. We've gone through all these cycles that, you know, and of course, they're always the smartest people in the room. So we're supposed to listen to everything they've got to say, but John Holdren, the same guy who was promoting global warming in the 1970s, co-wrote a book about how the whole planet was moving into another ice age and it was going to destroy society.
Yeah. It's, you know, there may be some truth to there being some warming of late, but it basically peaked in 98. And leveled off ever since. And then also, there have been historical, I mean, in the medieval period, there was a period of this, you know, in which nothing happened. And so CO2 is supposedly this evil chemical, right? It is actually the
gas of life.
It's the air that plants breathe.
Right. Right. The more CO2, the healthier the plants are, the less water they require, and the better they grow, and they'll grow in much poorer soil.
And they're telling us that we need to replant trees while they're saying we're pumping excess CO2 into the atmosphere. That makes no sense. If we're pumping excess CO2 into the atmosphere, that will already increase plant life. So, it's just one thing after another. There are some environmental issues like plastic in the ocean, but it's nothing like they say it is. The coral dying reefs, that's all a lie. I mean, so they're making up catastrophe after catastrophe, and the point is to scare us to death into compliance, because a frightened population is a very compliant one.
Right, right. Fear is really the oppressor's favorite tool, because if you can get people afraid of their future, they'll give up their future.
Yes, fear is a big one, and looking at Soviet history, fear, basically, don't say the wrong thing, or we'll just come and grab you in the middle of the night, sending us to the gulag. No, well, they're not exactly doing that, but there's a lot of digital gulagging going on, which is an effective kind of death, in the sense that people are losing the only possible fears for communication that they have, because everything outside of the digital sphere has been basically made irrelevant or inert. You can't really get to an audience unless you're online somehow. So, nobody goes and stands on a soapbox in the town square unless they want to look like they're crazy. So there's no other way. The public sphere means nothing, and the rest is owned privately. So that makes for a difficult situation in which your speech is, and you know about the recent purge, the six that were purged from Facebook. This is just using this dangerous persons category and the hate group category under that. It's very interesting. I traced the language of this dangerous persons and organizations, and they used the exact same terms in the Soviet Union during the Great Terror. Exactly.
Wow. I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, you could read it in the book. It's a pretty big feature, so I don't want to give it all up right here.
Mm-hmm. Well, trust me, with our listeners, I like to think that we have a brighter than average listenership.
Oh, I bet.
And I'm quite certain that all you're doing with your conversation right now is getting a lot of people that will ultimately end up buying your book.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I'm working very hard on it, very feverishly, to get it out fast, because I want it to get out there before, it's precluded by certain factors, possibly. And also before, the rollout of some of these elements. But I think, and it's always a risk to be a speculator, because they can just call you crazy. So I tried to make everything tied down very tightly to real tight logic, real tight historical examples, based in, precedents and also parallel events taking place right before our eyes,
Right. Right. Well, I can tell you there's nobody in the world that, in my experience, that has a better understanding of reality than a reformed communist.
Absolutely. It's really uncanny how having been a communist makes you the most and the best effective anti-communist there is. Mm-hmm. And what they're ruling out is communism, and it should be understood as mostly political. See, the economic part of it is just an option, and really not a big option. The main part of communism is its totalitarian leftism. Whether they use corporations at the top or not doesn't really matter. They're monopolies anyway, just like the state is under state socialism. And then the main thing is the same ideology is perpetrated to affect the same result in the population. I really see no difference, but I do think it's what I call corporate socialism, or what I'm specifically referring to, and I borrowed this term from George Gilder, who used it, I think, way too narrowly in his book After Google. I took it and I said, "This is a great word, but man, you're just totally underusing this. This word means this phrase is stands for the future. Google Marxism. That's what we're headed towards."
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're spot on. And we've had Patrick Wood, we've had people on talking about technocracy and what a total chokehold it'll have on humanity when it's fully in place. And we're so close now that it's absolutely frightening that we're as close as we are to total control.
It's very interesting, too, because how it started with this. It started as a kind of a collaboration between the military, believe it or not, and some communitarian leftist hippie types. And the hippies looked at the internet as like a commons where you could go and be free of, you know, of a government. You know, John Perry Barlow was the typical, was the perfect example. He was an anarchist, a libertarian, at least civil libertarian, and basically, you know, just basically looked at the internet as a space of freedom, free association, free peer-to-peer exchange, and on and on. Well, it's parallel, isn't it a curious parallel between the way they sell socialism and the way it ends up? They sell it as this utopian world where the owners of production are the common people. There's no longer the boss, blah, blah, blah. And it always ends up as state monopoly over everything. So it's interesting that they use the same rhetoric, and some people are unwittingly dupes who are spouting it to sort of pave the way. For example, they first referred to that as, you know, the internet as the commons, and then it's become the cloud. And the cloud is very different than the commons in the sense that what? It's a space of control of all information possible, which is Google's goal. Google wants to have all information under their control and ownership. That and it's centralized, right? And then anything you get, any information you get, comes through their algorithms, which they direct you along certain paths into their knowledge base, which is the only one existing. That's the goal. That is incredible in its extent and ambition.
It is. It is. And the fact that they're so close to having that. We had a discussion some months ago about cryptocurrencies, and it's fascinating to me that the big central banks are now doing most of the research on cryptocurrencies. And, you know, they always figure out a way to control everything we do, and that's another example.
Yeah, in fact, it's probably possible to track that not only have they get a hold of it later, but they may have set it free in the first place and just made it look like something alternative and radical. This is what they do. This is what they've done with government. This is what they've done with different types of, you know, I mean, there's no way that socialism, like, for example, that rolled out in the USSR, that it is some sort of, you know, of oppositional, completely radical, coming from the opposite end of society ideology. It was birthed in the heart of the beast itself, you know, and they didn't. And it was promoted by the top capitalists in the world and bankers. So, I mean, how is that possibly going to end up in the favor of the vast majority? Never.
Exactly.
But I think they do this each time. They leak it, make it look subversive, make it look radical, make it look alternative, make it look like the way. This is how to undermine the system. But meanwhile, it's just another loop back in.
Well, that's that's the trap, but at the same time, and I think you'd probably agree with me on this, that may be the difference between being totally controlled by them and finally getting young people to wake up to the reality of the world we live in. Because young people, I was one just like probably you were, who resisted the authority. And we resisted the authority. It's a natural thing. But when they find out that the authoritarians are the ones that are converting all their thought processes into mainline, they're going to be resisting, I believe.
Yes. I mean, like, I don't know about your age, but I'm 16, to be honest, and I'm not afraid of telling or ashamed of it by any stretch. I basically came into a teenage years in the 70s, you know. I saw this, now, as I look back on it, I coached city tennis in Pittsburgh. I was a tennis player, so I taught tennis for the city, and then I coached a team, and they gave us, like, the rule book and all this stuff. Curiously, when I thought of the rule book, it was basically the idea that we don't really want competition at all here. Just everybody wins. Nobody has a bad time. And it's all about cooperation, not individualism. It's all about the group. So, interestingly, they were permeating these basically collectivist ideals through documents like this, through programs like this. And I thought, oh, yeah, this is great. Wow, this is great. This is against capitalism. Wonderful, you know. And I talk about this in my book. Some popular culture that did the same, like Gilligan's Island, which is a subtle but not really that subtle socialist, Robinson Crusoe tale, collectivist Robinson Crusoe tale, you know, in which basically they were condemning capitalism and self-interest all the way in every single episode. And that was in the 60s. So. You know, it's been going on for a while, and one has to wonder, and I started to wonder, how and why would these corporations be allowing this or actually doing it? And that's really what set me on the path that I've been on for the last 2 or 3 years.
Well, you certainly come a long way in 2 or 3 years. I've been on this path since about 63 or 64, and I was a young teenager at the time that the Kennedy assassination occurred, and the whole process, what happened, how it was explained, and everything else was it was so bizarre that I started to pay attention, and I've spent the last. You know, well, I'm 68 years old, so I've spent the last, 55 years, something like that, going through my epiphany, and I can tell you I am impressed because it took me a long time, and I've read, I don't know how many hundreds of books, actually it's probably more than 1,000, to get where I'm at today, and you've got it nailed.
Yeah, appreciate that. I mean, it's just been basically being vexed has been the issue, you know. Things vex me so much that I have to figure it out. And that's basically what I set my mind to do, is figure it out and to open up my mind to think that what could be going on here, you know. Wait a minute. Listen to yourself now. Just think about what is possible. Now, it makes you drop predilections and preconceptions about what's what and who's who. That's one of the first things to do, is to forget about what the left supposedly means and stands for. Forget about what the right supposedly means and stands for, and see what's actually happening with these things. And, you know, one of the main things that started off was this notion of woke capitalism, and why were these advertisers, in effect, promoting leftist ideals? And it just, you know, things like that, it just took me from there, and I just traced to a core in its history and all that. It's been liberating, very liberating. So what one thing I do want to leave people with is hope that you yourself can be free inside the gulag. You don't have to be a prisoner in the full sense of the term.
No, that's good. I want to mention the fact there's a couple of things that you're going to be a speaker at the Red Pill Expo in Hartford, Connecticut, coming up just a little over a week.
That's right.
I'm going to be there as well. I'm going to be the floor manager for that event, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to meet you and speak with you in person. And I want to get a copy of, signed copy of your book, and that's a great opportunity to do that.
Oh, I will have it with me for you, definitely.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I want to mention the fact that I told you the other day about the Red Pill University, or at least I wrote you about it. We've got that concept in play, and it sounds like you're going to be doing something very similar to that, and I am just thrilled. Every opportunity that we have as a culture and as a group of patriotic citizens to wake the world up. Let's be the watchman on the wall. Let's be the ones that are speaking truthfully on areas that the rest of the controlled media are doing everything in their power to try to hide.
And
that's what you want to do.
Yeah, and by no means do I necessarily have to do this in a lone wolf fashion. In fact, if we have very similar objectives, there's no reason not to combine our efforts and to see what happens, if that would be amenable to you. Because what I'm looking at is basically a premise. The premise is it's not so much what we're against, but it is something that has to be precluded, and that is, in effect, PC indoctrination. So to me, it has to be an anti-PC university, and that is to say, it cannot have its inquiry, its language use, its expression controlled, and basically the parameters of inquiry set by PC authoritarianism. Then anything goes, in my opinion. Inquiry of all types, all areas, all domains of human knowledge should be explored, and speculation. And I think, my vision was to have, like, everybody does talk shows. Talk shows are so overdone. Isn't it time that we had basically, whoever the sort of MC is, he introduces the speaker, but also gives a small lecture of his own to bracket it, to sort of foreground it. Then you open it up to questions. Let the lecturer lecture, read something, or else just talk it through. And then let the audience ask questions through the technology, and then answer the questions, and then have the host also ask questions, and then maybe give a closing statement. Enough of the talk shows. Why does everything have to be entertainment?
Right.
We do need to have entertainment, but we are desperately in need of knowledge. And it's really, we need to know whether what we've got is knowledge or not, too. Mm-hmm. So the criteria of knowledge have to be established or set up, an epistemology, that is, and things like that. I think it's a very important thing to do. And it could be like an alt university for students who are in the university, who aren't going to register for our classes or something like that, but they're going to get a chance. Hey, let's hear what alt university has to say about this topic, so they get another side of it without the university controlling it.
Well, I'm with you on making the statement that we're not here to make people think anything. We're here to allow people to hear different points of view. And you and I both, I agree on this, I know this. The truth will prevail. Science, actual science and not convoluted science, will prevail. The fact is, good ideas are good ideas, and they'll carry their own weight. The problem is we're dealing with all these goofy ideas, and people are using propaganda to sell things that otherwise couldn't be sold.
What's happening is that they have, if you want to look at it as a marketplace of ideas or a Darwinian struggle of ideas for existence, however you want to look at it, what it is they've eliminated the competing ideas, real competitive ideas, in advance, leaving only a lot of ludicrous things. And then there's no competition, so these ludicrous ideas get accepted, and then they're dogmatized. So, for example, there's no arbitration about in connection with empirical data, for example, about gender and things like that. There's no taking into account anything about, you know, chromosomes, biology. It's whatever people say they are. This passes for the truth. And the rest of the world's supposed to go along with it. And if you don't believe it and if you don't behave like it's true, you're going to be punished. So you have to effectively buy into mass delusion in order to be acceptable citizen. This is nuts. This is tyranny. This is tyranny.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's delusional. It's people buying into ideas that on their face couldn't carry water 5 feet. And
right.
yet they're buying into it because they want to get along. They want to be popular. They want to have people like them because they're afraid that if they stand out or if they say something that isn't PC, somehow
yeah.
they're going to be derided for their opinion.
Well, they will be. I mean, look what happened in Google. If you look at the DeMoor case, if you look at the James DeMoor Google lawsuit, there's a footnote there that says one of the people at Google identifies as a yellow, wingless, scaleless dragonfly kin and an elaborate, ornate building. That's their sexual identity, okay? Yet, they are still at Google, probably got promoted. To me, when I came up, I think they would have been sent to the psychiatric ward. But no, not now. That has to be absolutely deferred to. What do you do with a person like that? That's considered like, how do you talk to them? Do you knock on their forehead? How do you open the door? So on and so forth. But James DeMoor, who merely using research that showed that there might be a differential, and not only talent, a differential dispersion of talent, gender-wise, in terms of technology, but also preference.
Mm-hmm.
And all he did is present previously recorded arguments and in fact studies, and he fired him. So the yellow wingless dragonfly kin and elaborate ornate building as a job at Google, and the cis hetero gendered person who believes that gender may be real and there's only two of them is out. So there's got to be something more to it than just Google's just going along to get along. I think that they are doing this. It's part of the agenda to produce these different. First of all, what does it do? It undermines what I call social ontologies, like man, woman, child, right?
Mm-hmm.
These social
traditionalism.
Ontologies. Yes, mm-hmm. right. The family, for example. What is
mm-hmm.
the family? It's a unit that has a sort of semi-autonomy that could possibly resist other state and corporate power and ideological influence. You know, and they hate that. And Marx mm-hmm. hated the family, called for its abolition in the Communist Manifesto already in 1848. They wanted to get rid of the family. The family stands between the state and the individual.
And even
what
though he had a bunch of kids,
what's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but in spite of the fact that he had a bunch of kids and a wife, he took every opportunity to leave them, and literally several of his kids actually died of malnutrition.
Yeah, I mean he was a monster personally, and actually
mm-hmm.
he had aristocratic pretensions as well. He hated the bourgeoisie, but he really wanted to be an aristocrat. That was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the family, what better way of getting, there were a lot of approaches to getting rid of the family. One of them, in terms of the African-American family, was pay the mother to get the father the hell out of the house. That
right.
might really help them, right? Now, how about if we get rid of the actual constituents that make up the family, like man and woman? Mm-hmm. We get rid of those pieces. There's no longer a family, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. That's exactly what's going on.
Exactly, and promote homosexualism and things. Keep in mind, under you,
polymorphism. You know,
well, under UN Agenda 21, they fully plan to have the world's population to fewer than a billion people within the next 50 years. How in the world are they going to do that unless they do some of these crazy programs of theirs?
Yes. Yes. Also, robo sex bots are definitely coming. Mm-hmm. And you know, basically, they're going to make you fall in. You know, they're going to try to make people accept sex with a robot. I guarantee it. It is on the way. I mean, there's already prototypes out there. They want to put it such that, you know, and then they're going to give robots rights. So, you know, human rights. So, hey, you can't discriminate against that robot. You know, so if you don't marry or have sex with it, you know, that could be discrimination. In fact, this is what the trans community is trying to do right now. Trans women, i.e. men, who are pretending to be women, suggesting that lesbian women must have sex with them or else they're being discriminatory. Even though they have penises and these women are lesbians, they don't want to have sex with people that have penises. That's the whole point.
The lunatics really, truly are running the asylum.
And they're given control of it, just like during the exactly like during the Cultural Revolution, when Mao told the Red Guards, the kids, the students, do it all, destroy everything, all of the artifacts, all of the cultural heritage, all of the intellectuals, get the intelligentsia to rip them to shreds. They're effectively given the green light by the powers that be to do it.
And they're going to get away with it if we don't stand up and wake up.
Yeah, I'm trying my best. You know, I'm trying my best to reach as many people. I know you are, you know. Without, you know, of course, they have the ways of dismissing you. You know, I don't think this guy Richard Spencer wrote the book, not to be confused with Richard Spencer, wrote this book called "The Wall Street and the Bolshevik or the Russian Revolution" in 1905 to 1925, and he says, you know, he went and addressed the issue of conspiratorialism and that being accused of it. He said this, you know. Everybody conspires. I mean, you and I are conspiring right now to get a point across. This is a conspiracy. Anytime two or more people collaborate and try to push an agenda, that's a conspiracy.
Exactly.
Conspiracy is the actual norm. Non-conspiracy is the exception. So everything is conspiracy. So to be dismissed as a conspiracy theorist is just, it's just the weakest ad hominem garbage, you know, they can come up with.
Well, it is, and it's a way that they can identify and vilify people for standing out, because the bottom line is it's all about conformity to the collective, and that's what it's all about.
Indeed. I was told in no uncertain terms about NYU, conform to the norm, quote, unquote.
Wow. That's scary. That's scary. And that's what
university.
That's what they're teaching our educators. And I'm 68 years old, but I can tell you that was going on when I was in college in the late 60s.
Sure. It just escalated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been working on it for a very, very long time.
Well,
Michael, one of the things that you're going to be speaking at the Red Pill Expo coming up in about a week and a half. And one of the things that one of the groups that I support, I'm one of the original members, Ed Griffin started this group called Freedom Force International. And what we, the one thing that we require conformity to is that we stand for individual liberty, and we are against collective liberty. We are against collectivism. And
that's right. There is no good of the whole. There's no good of the people. There's no general good at all. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing as the good of the people. It's always against the person, every time. Right.
Every time. And that's the bottom line. If you don't have individual liberty, you will never have collective liberty.
Yeah, that's right. There's no good of the whole. There's no the people. There's not, you know, anytime they use language like that, you know you're in trouble if you, you know, the people were sacrificed to the people in the Soviet Union. You know, I mean, everything was done in the name of the people. They killed the people in the name of the people. You know, they imprisoned them in the name of the people. Mm-hmm. And they were enemies of the people, even though they were the people, you know.
Collectivism is evil. It is evil, and you know, I think of the starvation of the Ukraine early in Stalin's reign, and it was, of course, because they were saving the crops and the agriculture for the people, but in fact, they ended up having to buy most of their grain and stuff from overseas because they couldn't feed anybody.
It started a famine. It was a state-induced famine that lasts from, you know, 32 to 33. People died, and it is just one horror show after another when you read the interest, you know, the first 20 years until they stabilized the hellhole system that basically was getting its funding off of the West and all of its machinery too, which Anthony Sutton points out. I mean,
right.
They never, all the equipment, everything was Western supplied. So there was no socialism. It didn't exist. It never would and it never could. It was a state that was kind of a satellite state they tried to use to set up a place for monopolies and to eliminate potential competitors. That was the key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Armand Hammer, who happened to be a real good mentor and friend of Al Gore Sr., was best friends with Joseph Stalin.
He was a corporate socialist.
A Ford Motor Company built the truck plant that they were hauling Viet Cong down the Ho Chi Minh Trail against American troops in Southeast Asia. This collusion has been going on literally in front of our very eyes, in front of our noses, the entire time.
Yeah. There's another book. It's not so well written, but it's called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. I forget the author's name, but it's the same topic, and it's going, you know, it just makes it very clear that socialism never was really about and had no intention of serving the good of the so-called people, which can't be done, as we know. But rather, it was always about the consolidation of power at the top, a consolidation and oligarchical limitation to wealth and power to among a very few. It's always been that way, and it'll never be anything else.
Well, you mentioned Anthony Sutton, and I've read that book, and the fact that a Schiff in the Morgan Bank and the Schiff family put $20 million into the Bolshevik Revolution. They're the ones that got Trotsky out of Canada and got him into the fray in Russia during the revolution.
And they put $10,000 in his pocket. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And they put $11 million in his gold in his bank, in a bank account under his name. In New York. So he was getting rich. He may have been. There are true believers, like Stalin, I believe, was a true believer in state socialism. I think Trotsky was probably a snide, sort of sneaky corporate socialist who was not really a believer, but sort of knew how to make people hear him. And so, he used the socialist ideology, but he really was into corporate socialism. But it doesn't make any difference for those that's subjected to it.
Well, in fact, the term neocon, and I've read this and heard this, the term neocon, believe in socialism. They believe in Trotsky form of socialism, which is corporatism.
That's right. It's no surprise that all of the neocons came out of the Trotskyist tradition. They're all Trotskyites. So, I mean, there's got to be a reason why that is. You know, they're corporate socialists. That's right. Trotsky was a corporate socialist. He was in it definitely for the money. And they said he was exiled, and the Trotskyists believed that he was the answer. And, you know, if it weren't for his exile, if he would run the country, he was just Stalin in waiting. That's all. That's all he was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he killed people too. He had people shot. He was a mass. He was also a monster, a total monster.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's never worked. Every attempt to try to make socialism work has been a failure. And of course, they use Denmark and Norway and Sweden as examples of how successful socialism can be. And then, in fact, those countries are failing as we speak because of their own programs.
Yeah, they're overloaded. They're not really socialists. They're social democracies, but they're nevertheless overburdened with social programs that can't be supported. The people don't understand that you have to have accumulation of capital to have wealth production, and it just has to be in private hands for very, very important reasons, and that is to have a notion of what anything is worth. So there has to be a market for that, for the means or factors of production. And without a market, you're basically producing blindly. You know, socialism claimed that it was about producing democratic economics or economic democracy. What is economic democracy? It's where the people get to choose what's made and how much and all that. Well, it can't be done because there's no way of knowing what anything's worth when you don't have any prices. Prices are an indication of value that people put on things, you know. So then how much they want it. It's a real rich indication of demand and other things, right?
Mm-hmm.
To get rid of that, then nobody's left. What are you left with? You're left with having to decide bureaucratically. Therefore, it's done by the centralized system. Therefore, it's the least democratic economic system there is. So once again, it's the absolute reverse of what they say it is.
Right. Well, we all hear the horror stories about former Soviet Union, where they were giving bonuses to the workers for the amount of pounds of nails that they were producing in one of the factories there, and they ended up with nails that were so big and so heavy they couldn't be driven.
Yeah, you get this absurd. You know, a tumor of, you know, like this cancerous growth of production in areas, and then you have this sort of impoverishment in other areas, and there's no, none of it corresponds to wants or needs at all. It's just purely arbitrary almost. In fact, Stalin did say, we got to keep at least one capitalist country on the earth so that we could figure out what things should be worth, what prices we could put on it. So he knew deep down there was no way to do it without, you know, without pricing.
Yeah. Well, and you're right on with free markets. The idea of free markets is that you will find the right price based on supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
when you take away those free markets, you take away any semblance of balance in an economy.
And furthermore, you take away individual freedom because free markets allow people to exchange whatever talents or things they have in the marketplace as they will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the communists will say that's slavery because you have to make it into a commodity. So what? Okay, that's my answer to that. So what? Would you rather have your head shot off, or would you be able to? Would like to be able to be an entrepreneur. Take your pick.
It's that
simple, you know. Would you rather be shot in the head or be able to, you know, start a small business? You know, I mean, that's, to me, it's a no-brainer, you know.
Well, it is a no-brainer, and that's one of the things that I think a lot of people miss is the fact that when we lost our constitutional money system in 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve, and now worldwide we have a financial system that's 100% fiat, and and very, very shortly will be 100% digital with no such thing as cash money. What a great plan to control the world.
Yeah. Yes. It's going to be a digitized fiat economy, and who knows what's going to back it, really. Which governmental force or what? It could be, like I said, this collapse of corporatism into government. And that would be the backing of it, I guess, because that would probably also be the only place to spend it, right? So everything is cyberspace. You know, everything will be cyberspace. There's not going to be going on the internet. You'll be in it. You'll be in the internet. You're just you're another piece of digital information. That's what you're going to be. And therefore, all things. It's not going to be the internet of things. It's going to be the things of the internet. Everything will be of and in the internet. That's what I think's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what 5G represents, because in reality, you're right, we become part of the internet atmosphere, or I don't know what the right term for that is, but we become the internet itself. We lose our identity.
The internet is going to be ubiquitous, and it is going to be it'll saturate all social space. So that all social space will be cyberspace. You could travel to the end of the earth and go to the Grand Canyon and stand on the precipice of a vast chasm. You will still be in the internet. There will be very few places of escape, if any. So that's what it'll be. It'll be in the internet. Cyberspace will be all around us. Then I have this part of my book where I have a former Soviet prisoner who had gotten released from the gulag, eventually was able to defect from the Soviet Union and got asylum in the U.S. And there's a scene where he's able to go back to the gulag to visit his previous self there through digitization, where everything has been digitized, even the past itself. It's kind of science fiction, but it's fun. Yeah, I'm trying to show some things like this, though, that it's going to be such that there is no outside of what I'm calling the Google archipelago. There'll be no outside of it. There is no inner outside of the gulag. It's everything.
It's everything. And Michael, I'm sure this is probably also a part of your book, the fact that people will no longer travel anywhere. Everything will end up being virtual reality, and you'll be just a totally controlled, and, you know, they can do whatever they want with you because everything in your life will be virtual.
That's right. You're a piece of data. Some of these critics have called a digital. You're a digital individual, not a digital individual, but a digital individual. And a piece of data that is going to be, you know, basically seen, tracked, you know, it's a packet. Everything about you is basically a packet of data, and that'll be kept track of, you know. But one of the things I'm really upset about is, like, the way academic scholarship of the digital sphere is all about capitalism. That's the problem, man. They're making money, and everything you do online is you're being exploited. You know, when you go on and do a Google search, you're being exploited because you're giving free labor to do, you know, Google. If you go on Facebook and you post a status, you know, you're giving free labor away. You're exploited. I really crushed that idea that's the issue. You know, that you're being exploited by Facebook. There's some of these theorists they compare posting on Facebook to slavery. Okay. That's how insane they are. because it's free labor. Oh, my God. So this is where the establishment academic critics of cyberspace are at, completely missing the picture entirely, and I think intentionally.
Yeah, I can't help but think you're absolutely right. They're the ones that are steering the ship. They may not admit it, but the fact is it's their goofy ideas that they're training the young people to accept.
At least what they are is ideological apologists, and they're also a diversionary tactic to make people think, oh, we're going to be radically criticizing the internet because we're talking about how they're exploiting us and they're gaining capital off of us, when really what they're doing is imprisoning us. That's much more important. The political aspect is really what's the question here. I mean, there is an economic part too, but it's not about what they're suggesting. That's purely diversionary. So there's always this diversionary radicalism that is thrown up. And it's really hard to resist for some people. Because it seems, you know, people like to feel saucy. They like to feel edgy. They like to feel, radical, or like a lot of people do. They like to feel like they're radical and that they're at the cutting edge. But actually, they're actually serving the very interest they think they're undermining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. They're doing that now, and we're getting toward the end of the program. But I want to explore ways that that we can escape the matrix, ways that we can be part of the solution instead of being continuing to be part of the problem. And that's what our Red Pill Expo is about, and I know that's what you're going to be dealing with in your talk at the Red Pill Expo. So let's talk about ways to escape the matrix.
Well, as I said, I think before, you can be in it, but not of it, in a sense. That sort of sounds like Christian language, and maybe it's possible that there is a reason for the use. And that is to say, your compliance with it is not contingent upon being subjected to it. You can actually have your own thoughts, have your own self-determination, and be, you know, semi-autonomous or autonomous as possible, given the conditions we're in. So you're resisting it all. You know, it's not like the Trump resistance, which is all astroturf politics. This is real individual. All resistance that matters is done on the individual level. That's the only thing that counts. Anything that's massified is garbage, always. So it's a lonely place, but we can communicate to each other from where we are. And that, I think, is fundamental. Mm-hmm. We have to keep open these channels of communication, and we need to get these ideas out to each other and to make sure that you're not alone to seeing these things. They are happening, and so on and so forth. I don't have, like, some big escape plan plotted yet. I'm not Spartacus or something like that. I'm not sure. I really don't. Haven't got. You know, I've gotten far. I've gotten far, as you said, but not that far.
Well, one of the things I would suggest, and you're certainly alluding to this, is rather than having an escape plan, let's start being warriors for the truth. Let's start standing up and being the kind of people that always represent what's reality and not their perceived reality.
Right. Indeed. This is key. We have to be able to be neos, if you will, and crack the code and continually crack it and to show what's what, you know. And so we're being, you know, there's code being thrown out there and there's a lot of takers. Most people you talk to are infected. And they're talking through shit, you know. I'm sorry, excuse that language, but they're basically spewing code-generated garbage. So, what I think we do is, on those terms, is you cut into it in those moments. Find opportunities to cut the parade the procession of code-ingested and code-induced versions of reality, and then, you know, at every opportunity, you know, without risking your life, because you want to stay around and be able to do it further, you know, intervening with something that's different and throwing you off the consensus, if possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's and the thing that we've got to do, we've got to be willing to point out that the emperor has no clothes, and
right.
be the person that actually stands up for what's right, and not be the person that goes along to get along. And the fact is, I think the young people will eventually fall in line with that kind of leadership.
Yes. That's right. You don't jump on the call-out bandwagons of destroying people over so-called infractions of social justice ideology. These are the program minions of the cultural revolution of, you know, the digital age. You know, these are the digital Red Guard. You know, you don't go along with them, and you find ways to undermine them, cut them down at their knees. Show them what idiots they are. Show them what horrible people they are, because they are. They're acting that way anyway. They've been made to act that way. They're redeemable. Everybody is. But they need to be released from this crap, you know. So
yeah.
That's what I never, you know, try, and certainly never pile on to this insidious, struggle sessions, if you will, or digital struggle sessions that they undertake against dissent.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've felt all along, and I know you feel the same way, is that we should never attack individual people. We should attack their ideas. We should
That's right.
always be the kind of, let's say, soldiers that attack ideas instead of
That's
people.
Right.
That's
Absolutely.
The difference between us and them, because they don't have the truth on their side, so they
mm-hmm.
attack individuals.
That's right. They're not really using ideas either. They're just using plug-and-play rhetoric that supposedly, by virtue of some sort of resonance that it has been charged with by the culture, it's supposed to, by itself, make you fall over. You know,
mm-hmm.
don't
mm-hmm.
buy that. Don't buy that nonsense, that resonant, that supposed resonance that's supposed to be there. Just, you know, stick with your argument. Yes, I agree. Never at the man, at the argument. When I say cut people down, I don't mean them personally. What I mean
Sure.
is undermine their premises, undermine their assumptions that they're not ever articulating, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And like I say, point out the fact that the emperor has no clothes, because their ideas don't carry water. They really don't.
No. They're anti-empirical.
Well,
they're anti-reality. Yeah.
Anti-science, anti-everything that they claim to
mm-hmm.
be so closely associated with. Michael, I want you to use the last couple of minutes of our radio program here to talk about the things that you're involved with, the books that you've written, and how people can find out more about you.
Well, I've got finally everything together. On my own site, you'll find essays that are not anywhere else, michaelrechtenwald.com, Michael Rechtenwald, RECTENWALD.com. And there you will find all my books. There are 9 of them. You'll find essays I'm writing constantly. I just wrote an essay called The Point de Capitan of Leftist Ideology. That means the quilting point. What is the kernel of leftist ideology? I've written, you know, I just pour these things out, put them out on the internet. It's how I practice my work for the books, which come out, you know, differently. So like all my appearances, all the interviews, all that, hopefully this one as well, will be linked there. And, you know, you can keep tracking me through michaelrechtenwald.com. Also, my Twitter is anti-PC NYU prof. That's anti-PC NYU prof. And that is, you know, I mean, you can find that on michaelrechtenwald.com as well. My books, next one is Google Archipelago, coming out soon. And the previous is Springtime for Snowflakes, if you haven't read it. It's a guess.
Well, I'll tell you what, I am fascinated. I can't wait to meet you in Hartford. I'm looking forward to that experience. You are a fascinating individual. You're a terrific interview. And I have to say, I really look forward to walking shoulder to shoulder with you against the New World Order, because the reality is we are really the ones that we're in the majority, whether they want to admit it or not. And
right.
Like you say, they always play the underdog. But
right.
In truth, they've got most of our institutions under their control.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's time to fight back, and like you say, I look forward to seeing you at the Red Pill Expo. And
feelings
Michael,
mutual, I assure you.
Well, make sure that you've got at least a copy of Springtime for Snowflakes, and I hope your new book is out.
I'm
going to
give you as many chapters of Google Archipelago privately by PDF. As I have done by that time.
Completely with that document. And I just want to, so you see where I'm going, and you can help me. Open to feedback, definitely.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And I've been in this battle a long time myself, and so all I can say is I am really thrilled when I run across a true patriot like yourself. That and again, it's it's like a smoker. I used to be a smoker, and it's been a long time ago. I am the most anti-smoking guy in the world, and I think it's the same with communists.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And the same way about communism. Indeed.
Yep. When you see
thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Michael, and I ask our guests to please join us again next week for Connecting the Dots. And, Michael, I look forward to seeing you in Hartford, Connecticut in about a week and a half. Thank you again for being our guest, and we'll look forward to the next time we get a chance to meet.
I can't wait.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence from the Brits. It was revolution. Now an enemy from within would enslave us all again and deprive us of our rights in the Constitution. Restore the Republic. Wake up, it's time to